Before we get into today's episode, we wanted to briefly talk about the protests and uprisings that have been going on in all 50 states and around the world in support of Black Lives Matter, a cause we absolutely support, even though we have to admit this has generally been a whitey white podcast. That's not due to any intention on our part, but that's how unconscious bias works. We could have done a lot more to interrogate ourselves on that and on our blind spots before now. We didn't, and that's our failure to own.
Our next few episodes are booked, so you're not going to notice a change right away. But due to the conversations that have arisen around the recent protests, as well as in response to feedback from listeners who want us to do better, we are changing the way we book the show, the way we program our lead topics, and the way we're broadening our pool of guests.
In the meantime, we are going to listen, learn, and support the vision of Black organizers and open up our wallets. Picking up the baton from our friends at WHO Weekly, we are donating half our ad revenue from this month to a pair of very worthy causes.
First, the Minneapolis Sanctuary Hotel, a mutual aid community that sprang up spontaneously during the uprisings in the city at the end of May and has housed close to 200 people so far, in addition to providing a variety of other services.
Second, the Homeless Black Trans Women Fund in Atlanta, supporting women who lack resources at the best of times, which this is not.
We'll link both of these in the show notes if you want to learn more about the projects and possibly support them directly yourselves.
Thank you for supporting us while we try to figure our shit out. And now, today's episode.
Remind me again why we do this.
Because it's our job.
This is the Extra Hot Grape Podcast, episode 306 for the week of June 8th, 2020. I am anti-terrorist WD-40 can David T. Cole, and I'm here with Rhino sitter Sarah D. Bunting.
Sit. Good Rhino.
Revolutionary sellout Tara Ariano.
We are the law.
And mother who's never held down a job, Stephanie Green.
But I have a degree in mournful staring.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Extra Hot Grape. Before we get into talking about our lead topic, probably briefly, we got a little site business. Our at program EHG hashtag contest is still underway. We got about another week to go. Reminder, you will get to program an episode of this podcast. You will tell us everything we need to know to create a podcast. What's the lead topic? What do we have to argue the canon for? What kind of game are we playing? Et cetera, et cetera. You don't have to be on the podcast. In fact, you won't be on the podcast, but you get to tell us all the building blocks of an episode. The cost of entry is on Twitter or Instagram or even by email. You have to describe a show you may want us to cover in exactly 6 words. So on Twitter, where we are Extra Hot Podcast, just hashtag your entry program EHG. On Instagram, which is weird and bad with hashtags, trying to track them, I will have a post up the day this comes out. Just reply in there with your entry. And if you want to send one by email, do so david@cole.fyi with the title program EHG, so I know what it's about. And we will announce some winners next week.
On to our lead topic, which is the Cinemax import from South Africa, Trackers.
Trackers.
Trackers. Joining us this week is our guest, Stephanie Green. Hello, Stephanie.
Hello.
Stephanie.
Hi, guys.
Yay!
Stephanie hasn't been on in quite a while because she was having another baby who's now big enough for her to be able to leave her alone. Unfortunately, we have had Stephanie back for a real dud of a show. I think I speak for all of us. I guess I'll find out if I'm wrong. Trackers is based on a book series, apparently. When we said last week that this is what we were talking about, recent guest Danny McEachern said he looked it up to see if it was the books that he had read and was excited to find out it was, because apparently the books are really good. Something got lost in translation. Again, we'll find out if we all agree. Broadly, it revolves around the Presidential Bureau of Intelligence in South Africa, basically a domestic CIA. It's an informant tells an agent about a package that's being moved by a small local Islamist terrorist group that's partnered with a senior Al-Qaeda operative. At the same time, a woman named Mila is leaving her abusive husband and gets a job as a researcher, officially at a news magazine, but actually at this division. And a smuggler named Lemmer is very reluctantly taking a very lucrative job. And Janina, the head of the PBI, is hearing from the justice minister that due to her fuck-up on an earlier case, the division is at risk of getting shut down. But what is Lemmer smuggling that could possibly pay him so well? It's a rhino. So we find that out at the end of the first episode, which has already aired. So I had kind of hoped this would be the fun kind of smuggler story with a lot of, you know, ingenuity about how they get around law enforcement.
Musical numbers.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say no, but this
What
just...
are we tracking today? Rhinos! What are we tracking tomorrow? Diamonds!
Stop pitching a better show. This just felt very stilted and old-fashioned. Even though a calendar tells us it's 2019, all of the other nations that I think import American formats of shows are years behind on, you know, what is in them, I think. And this feels like 24 in its heyday, which is like 15 years ago. Stephanie, what did you think of Trackers?
I don't understand what the hook is here, other than that it's set in South Africa. Mm-hmm. I don't understand why this wasn't just left in South Africa. Maybe like South African viewers would hook into this more because it takes place there. But for international viewing audience, especially Americans, like you said, this feels slow, generic, despite the specific setting of being in Cape Town and the Karoo and whatever. It just feels like a generic sort of like crime story with lots of guns. And my eyes sort of glazed over when all the guns came out. That always happens with gun shows like Sons of Anarchy, which I used to recap. Oh my God. So I don't know. There's nothing there. The protagonists aren't interesting. They're two-dimensional.
Oh, two-dimensional is doing that lead, the Merc, a favor. Because that guy is just like, he stares in the middle distance. That is his character quirk.
Lemmer.
Right.
Yeah.
So I guess I don't understand why anyone would choose this over any of the other million things that are on TV. It felt flat. And maybe if they had done more context or like explaining about some of the like South Africa specific dynamics, it would have worked, but they didn't because this was made for South African viewers originally. So I think this is maybe something that just shouldn't have been exported because there's not a lot there.
There's a threshold that you imagine when something is imported from around the world to be viewed in the States. And I feel like that's been messed with recently because of all of the new entrants in the streaming game. You know, not only now do we have network and cable, Netflix, and now Peacock and Disney, and everybody just is starved for content. So I feel like that threshold right now is moving down. Until that bubble bursts, I think we're going to have more shows that are like this. It's not a bad show. It's just boring in there, right? It's just like, it's another oatmeal show. It just happens to be from South Africa, but it's not from South Africa in an interesting kind of way. It's just a very generic story. It reminds me of the Secret City ads that's from Australia with Anna Torv. You know, it feels like that kind of show, small stakes, for a smaller country kind of show. Also kind of put me in the mind of Press from the UK. Also, there's a Canadian show called Intelligence that seems very similar to this in scope and ambition, which is, you know, not a lot. And it just feels like we are in this weird spot in the television industry where things are exploding, but like the universe expands and contracts, is going to contract sooner than later. And then this kind of show, we just wouldn't be in front of our eyeballs anymore.
Yeah. Sarah, what did you think?
I think as many of us are doing in the last few months, you're always grading on a curve of like between the pandemic and the protests, there's like a double curve now that all entertainment, I think, is being graded on, like how jarring is how obvious that this is from the before time is. And because this is basically like a government cop procedural, it's like you really have to show me something else besides like, you know, rogue, silent, like son of Christian Bale and Randall Batenkoff staring into the middle distance. Like, get him a clean shirt and give him something to say, because this isn't particularly interesting. I started having like real anxiety when the rhinos showed up. Like any time that they were on screen, I was like freaking out that they were going to die. This is the kind of thing that a control freak in 2020 seizes on, and it's not enjoyable. I just felt like I was waiting and waiting and waiting for all the threads to braid together. And they, I guess, did, but then I didn't care. And I was like, well, sometimes it's the third episode that makes the difference. Listener, it is not. you are excused. This just isn't there. It's not enough. And whatever the reason for that is, the fact that we're all interrogating our involvement with cop shows or we're distracted by other things, whatever the reason, this is not enough. And I agree with the previous comments that I think the South African-ness of this is not coming through in a way that gives us enough context to keep caring.
If I can paint a picture of just like the excitement level of this show, the big set piece in episode one is two members of the intelligence agency trying to install a camera at the hideout of these extremists.
Yeah.
And the big tension device was that the guy couldn't unbolt a nut. Yeah. And
oh no, there was also the dropping of a tape and rolling away.
So, you know, he spends 5 minutes trying to unmount a satellite dish so he can feed it a camera through it. His partner drops the tape and he's still, you know, and he has to get the can of WD-40 to loosen the bolt so he can unscrew it so he can drill into the wall and put a camera. And I'm like, this, if you didn't tell me this was South African, I would say this has got to be a Canadian TV show. You know, it has the whiff of CanCon, whatever the South African equivalent is of homegrown content, as a prerequisite for funding. It has that kind of whiff to it.
Yeah.
To me.
So I lived in South Africa for a while in Johannesburg, and I kept expecting to be reminded of like uniquely South African things while I was watching this, like, oh, I remember that. And no, I mean, there was like nothing.
Oh man.
Except there was one scene where a guy walks into his like safari lodge house and there's a wooden giraffe. And I was like, oh, we had that wooden giraffe in our apartment. Otherwise I was just like, ugh, it was so boring. Just nothing. Nothing was interesting about it.
And just like the characterizations, like there's a researcher mother who's just like a total drip. Her son is like the most punchable character ever.
She's very sad.
The Merc, who's just like, his main character trait is that he probably smells really salty because he never changes his clothes. You know, like there's not a lot of good characterization or good writing going on here too. So it's just like a blah show, and it's just a blah show. So not recommended.
Yeah.
No.
Just one thing I want to say about this level of sort of show that I've noticed is this and like The Rook. Remember we talked about The Rook about a year and a half ago?
Yeah.
When they don't have a lot to work with as far as the personality of the show, they do this thing where they just take elements of the show or the location, they put it through a kaleidoscope filter for the credits. And those are the credits. Yes. They're very lazy credits. And Tara said they reminded her, or they're a ripoff of Rosehaven, but they're not. Like, Rosehaven is like bespoke for the show. Mm-hmm. This is very just like they had a After Effects template and they just threw in some South African buildings and boom, we're done.
Yeah.
And The Rook was the same way.
Bosh also has those credits.
Oh, really?
I don't forgive that. they're bad.
Well, watch Rosehaven instead. The first season's on Prime.
Or Bosh.
Time to go around the dial. First up, Tara.
Well, it had been a couple of weeks since the launch of HBO Max, so I thought I should engage with some HBO Max original content. And for whatever reason, I chose Love Life. This show, the premise is, it's a half hour sort of dramedy. The idea is that most people, before they settle down with whoever their permanent person is going to be, will be in seven significant relationships. And so each episode is about a different one of those relationships in the life of Darby Carter, played by Anna Kendrick. Not Darcy Carden, alas, I would watch that show. But anyway, So we start back in time. The first episode takes place in 2012. The next one is 2013. In the first episode, she's dating this guy who's a writer for Politico, and they break up mostly because he's going on the road for the campaign. And then they get some, you know, cute lines to the effect of like, can you imagine if Romney was president, the world would fucking end. Ha ha. We get it. There's a wild swing between this guy who's like roughly her own age. And then in the next episode, her boss or ex-boss who is freshly divorced, and he's played by our old friend Scoot McNairy.
Scooty.
Yeah. So this is a show, I only watched the first two. I think six are up right now. That may be all of them. This is a show that's going to rise or fall on how much you buy in on the Anna Kendrick experience. And I feel like I have never personally given any performer more chances than I have given her for some reason, and I think I might be done. She just rubs me the wrong way. I can't put my finger on it. She's not like an enemy to the, you know, Deborah Messing, Julie Bowen end of the spectrum. She just bugs me.
It's that mosquito bite that just won't go away and you have to keep on scratching it?
I don't know. People like her so much. I guess I just want to see like what they see in her.
Wasn't she on your favorite show ever?
Bodega Boys? Oh, yeah. She's been on Deezus America.
She was okay
a couple
on
times.
That.
Sure.
But not in her roles.
No, she was playing herself.
Yeah, it was a candid piece.
Yeah. Yeah, people love her in like the Pitch Perfect movies. They love her in whatever she was nominated for an Oscar for. The plane movie.
So there's something wrong with you is what you're saying.
Is there? I mean, she wrote a memoir, which like really when she was in her 20s or possibly very early 30s, that was like a book of essays, which like, first of all, really. And then she called it Scrappy Little Nobody, which like fucking barf. And at this point, she had already been nominated for an Oscar. Like, gross. Anyway, if you like Anna Kendrick, this is probably your jam. It's like Anna Kendrick times Modern Love, that show that I also don't really like on Amazon, but that's my review. So on to other kinds of trash. Married at First Sight Australia. As Dave mentioned, a lot of networks are scrambling around to fill gaps on their schedule with, you know, imports from other nations.
Yeah, and they're also trying to get ahead of the COVID drought that's about to hit television too. Yeah.
Yes. Married at First Sight is a prime example of a show that you can't shoot when people are, you know, self-isolating for very obvious reasons. So instead of trying to shoot wherever their next season was supposed to be, they have imported season 7 of Married at First Sight Australia. And the premise is the same as Married at First Sight America. Couples are matched by supposedly expert matchmakers and they meet at the altar and they get married and then shit happens, usually bad. This season has so many couples. They start with, Stephanie, they start with 6 couples.
That's too many.
5 was too many on American Married at First Sight last season. 6 is too much.
Well, they have to account for attrition because of all the things that kill you in Australia. They step out, there's a snake or a spider or like a, you know, a koala gives you chlamydia or whatever, you know.
Sure.
Like, you got to be careful. You got to think ahead and pack that studio.
Sure.
Yeah, it's true. Like a scorpion in the shoe. Well, that's 2 couples right there.
Right.
And actually, the way things have been going with the recent seasons in the U.S., they usually have at least 1 couple like drop out in short order. So
that is true.
Maybe 6 isn't so crazy if you're assuming, you know, some people are not going to make it to that finish line.
Force majeure.
I guess. I mean, I did peek at Wikipedia to see how things go. And like there's more twists that was kind of surprising. But in addition to that, they have different kinds of people than are usually allowed on Married at First Sight America, such as single parents. One of the matches is a woman who has twins and a guy who has kids also. But his kids are like older teens or possibly like young 20-somethings, and her children are like infants. And she has left them like with question mark. I mean, they may have said who they were left with and I wasn't paying attention. Very possible. But then at the wedding, she like at the altar, she starts freaking out of like, wait, what have I done? Like, is now the time to start thinking, should I have left my twin infants, you know, to do this experiment with this guy I've never seen before in my life? In addition to which, like, all of the Married at First Sight America people, I would say, Stephanie, looked greater and less degrees like models. Some of them are like a little bit weird looking, but they all would not be out of place on The Bachelor. Like, they're pretty good looking. And this guy, not to say that he's unattractive, but he has like a young Brian Dennehy vibe, like, you know, maybe that's your jam. Maybe that's her jam. I don't know. But he's like, he would never get on a Married at First Sight America in a million years. Like, just would not. So, you know, that's an interesting dynamic where, like, through the actual ceremony and then into the reception, she's like crying because she's realized, oh, my God, what have I done to my literal tiny infant children by doing this wacky, wacky decision. And because apparently right before they frame it as same-sex marriage has just passed in Australia right before this season, they have a lesbian couple that get married on the show, which like also has never happened on Married at First Sight, even though gay marriage was legal in the States, at least for like from season two on, from when they've been
Married at First Sight is Lifetime here?
Yes.
Yeah, well, there you go.
I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, you know, those are some differences. It's some of the idioms are strange to get used to and kind of rankle, like when they say orientated or when they say different to instead of different than, which British people also do. And like, it bugs me. But, you know, I also don't have anything to watch because it's summertime. Yeah. So I might just stick with it.
Seems to be the theme of this episode.
Yeah, you won this round, Lifetime. So yeah, it's maybe worth sticking with. Stephanie, if you want to like jump on board, only a couple of episodes have aired. And I'm pleased to tell you that based on one of the promos that aired for one of the isolation episodes of Married at First Sight, regular American version, Austin from the last season cut his hair, which we're all happy to see. So,
oh, does he look way better?
He looks way better. I'm glad to relay this information to you.
I'm so happy.
We're
going to
drag you into the Love After Lockup club eventually.
We'll see.
Somehow.
For my plug, I wrote a post about Amy Schumer Learns to Cook and At Home with Amy Sedaris, two different takes on homemaking from two very different comedic Amys at Primetimer. And you can get that from the show notes. We will link it there.
Stephanie Green.
Okay, so I'm going to stick with the Australian theme. I want to talk about Please Like Me. I am 7 years behind when this show came out. And in my defense, I first heard about it in 2013. I went to a David Sedaris reading. And afterwards, you know, he talks to everybody. And I talked to him and he told me to watch this show. And I wrote it down and then didn't watch it for 7 years because I didn't know where to find it. And then I was like browsing Hulu in desperation to find something because, you know, hashtag 2020. And then I saw it. So I started watching it and it's really good, you guys. It's based on the stand up comedy of the creator slash star. His name's Josh Thomas. He is funny. However, my one caveat about this show is that his accent is bonkers, super weird. It's like Irishy, Northern Irish, hard to tell, English. We don't know. It does not sound Australian, and that's never addressed or explained. So I Googled it, and apparently his weird accent is like a thing that annoys lots of Australians online. That's beyond my pay grade, but basically you just have to like take your lumps and get used to his accent. And once it stops actively annoying you, maybe like a couple episodes in, then you can fully get into the show. So it's not a laugh a minute type comedy, but it is really funny. Even though it's kind of about dark subject matter. The first episode is about Josh coming out as gay after being dumped by his girlfriend. And then he visits his mother in a psychiatric hospital after her suicide attempt. And as the show goes on, Josh deals with his sexuality, dating, being an adult, his mother's mental health issue, and then other friends and partners' mental health struggles, including his own. And the show, I'd say it does a really fine balancing act between, you know, not making light of mental health issues, but finding moments of joy amidst challenges, the challenges the characters are facing. And it doesn't really minimize their struggles, but there's humor mixed in. So it has a great cast. Hannah Gadsby shows up in the second season. She is one of the mother's friends that she meets when she's in the psychiatric facility. So It's really good. And the final thing I'll say about the show is that the opening theme is such an earworm, and I like have it stuck in my head right now. I cannot. I don't know if you guys have heard the theme. It's so good. So I heartily recommend this show.
Nice.
Yeah. And then for my plug, I was supposed to have a story published by now in the New Ohio Review, but they pushed it back to June 19th. However, I want to still plug it because it's a story based on The Bachelor. It's a short story. It's so good.
Yay!
Thank you.
It's so good.
They asked me to do an audio recording of me reading it. And I was like, oh, God. And Sarah was so kind. And she edited the audio and made me sound less like terrible because I recorded it in my closet and was having coughing fits and stuff. So
you would never know you were a star. You, it's such a good story.
And then the other thing I wanted to quickly plug is that my brother-in-law in Canada has a clothing company. It's a streetwear company called Raised by Wolves. Those of your listeners who are actually cool may have heard of it. They are doing a GoFundMe to raise money for the Ottawa Food Bank. And if you donate, you can download a copy of their digital cookbook called Braised by Wolves.
That's
which is
so good.
I know. So it's a collection of recipes from chefs and other restaurants around Ottawa and Montreal. It's really good. And all the proceeds go to benefit a really good cause. So if you feel like doing some small thing to make the world a better place, I would recommend checking out their GoFundMe. And maybe you guys can post the link in the show notes.
We absolutely will.
Absolutely.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Okay. 13 reasons why. More like 13 reasons, colon, why. Season 4, I pray this is actually the final season for a bunch of reasons. I will get into it. Leaving aside, if we can, the fact that the show itself and the discussions around it seem like relics of another time. It's not the show's fault, but here is my issue. I think in the first season, there were a lot of conversations about the way that story was framed, and those conversations had real value. There was a debate about whether the narrative setup with the tapes, which was derived from the book, but regardless, turned suicide into a more glamorous mystery box narrative, or whether it was actually promoting discussion about depression and other mental illness in a productive way. All of that had value on top of appealing performances from the cast and so on. But then 13 Reasons Why, like there were other conversations feeding into and out of the original conversation, starting with sexual assault and the silencing of victims, particularly in high school. And then they brought in school shootings. And it's not that the show and the writing didn't take these issues seriously. It's that it took every single issue a high school drama could take on suicide, assault, homophobia, bullying, anti-immigration policy. It tried to braid all of these things together and tie them around a whodunit. And the whole thing, like, it's just so much. It's just so much. And there's like nothing else. There's like literally no sort of context or downtime in these children's lives where they're just like studying or having a frappuccino or whatever.
Sarah, it sounds like when you go to make something like from a recipe and you're supposed to combine all the ingredients in a bowl and stir it up. But when you put all the ingredients in the bowl, it actually fills the bowl and you don't have room to actually stir without spilling everything. It sounds like that as a TV show, the way you describe
it. Yeah, kind of. And also all the ingredients are things like shit. Bullets, like, I mean, and then it's sort of, you're like, come on, meniscus, don't spill it. I mean, it's just really a lot. And I think there's a conversation to be had about whether kids today, hello, fellow kids, like feel this enormous, the weight of all of these issues all the time and that they're not communicating with their parents. But first of all, you have 28-year-olds playing these kids at this point. That is another challenge. But by trying to do and address everything, in scenes that are going to feel irrelevant because everyone's like hugging and making out and sitting shoulder to shoulder at the cafe. It just ends up seeming kind of out of control. And then I accidentally read the synopsis of the, I hope, series finale. And it seriously is like, I know this much is true. Teen tournament.
No.
It's so, so much. Mm. Best of luck to everyone involved. But I quit season four 22 minutes into the first episode. And again, like, good luck to everybody. But this should not have been.
Wow.
For my plug. Dr. Marcia Chatelain is back on The Blotter Presents to talk about Dirty John, Betty Broderick, and a Laurie Benbenek Lifetime movie starring Tatum O'Neill. And if you don't think the late Ms. Benbenek's struggle to get justice is relevant to today's headlines, leave us not forget. Her whole story started because Bambi was trying to defund the police in Milwaukee and cancel Dr. Phil. Blotter Presents, wherever you get podcasts.
I watched Disney Gallery, The Mandalorian, which is their, we don't have any new content for all the nerds on Disney Plus since The Mandalorian went away. It's all just, you know, the featured Disney shows and stuff like that. So I get the feeling they scrambled to put together some sort of stopgap between this and whatever's going to come out next, which is like, seems still very far away. I think maybe the next thing is Captain America and the Falcon or one of those, or WandaVision. But it's still a ways off, and I get the feeling that they're losing a certain segment of their market. Each episode is a look at a different discipline when you make it. The first one's directing, but there's one about all the technology went into it. The reason I mention it, because, you know, it's not going to be of interest to anybody who isn't a Star Wars fan. Like, it's not like Heart of Darkness, where it is an exceptional documentary unto itself. It's not that, because it is a first party documentary. What else is it going to be besides, you know, yay, Star Wars, you know? But I mention it because Jon Favreau leads the discussion, and it is a very Dinner for Five-esque setup. And if you have fond memories of that show, you know, you can tune in for the first couple minutes and see him do that again. It's kind of cute. The one thing, this is for all the Star Wars people, the one thing in the first episode they're really pushing is, you can tell this is sort of like a Lucasfilm agenda, is they really want Dave Filoni, who was the George Lucas's sort of protege on the Clone Wars animated show and is rising up in the ranks, to sort of be the spiritual George Lucas now that George Lucas is gone. He's, you know, he has the best Lucasian takes on everything. You know, he knows about everything about Star Wars the way Lucas did. He can tell you what a Jedi would do or wouldn't do in a certain situation if you as a director come up to him and say, you know, this guy's got to make some coffee. How's a Jedi making coffee? Well, and he's sort of the heir apparent to that.
Right.
And I feel like there's a new generation of Star Wars fan that is attached to him, like the way I would have been attached to George Lucas, you know, 40 years ago. But I just do want to bring up that he is the one that introduced the time travel-y meets Phantom Zone world between worlds in Rebels. And it bugs me to no end when good sci-fi properties introduce that kind of thing. You know, it's my lazy writing in sci-fi. Now, I don't agree with that part of it. I think he does an okay job. Otherwise, they're obviously grooming him to be able to tackle live action projects, because he directed two episodes that were probably the worst two directed episodes of the season because he's the least experienced. But like, this is his path forward. As much as I hated that time travel-y thing, I do have to mention that George Lucas did one of my other hated things, which is shapeshifters in episode two, Attack of the Clones. Two things, once you introduce, you can't unintroduce them.
Yeah.
And then it makes everything so easy to write around. Like, you remember when Mission Impossible did the 100% accurate mask with the voice tape they put on their things? And it's like, now you could be anybody. And like, in the next movie, you can see them go, oh shit, this could solve anything we have to do. And suddenly, like, the 3D printer they used didn't have enough ink. And that was like a plot point in the next movie, like, to write themselves out of this get out of jail free card that, yeah, you have. So it was kind of interesting in that way. But mm-hmm. If you're a Star Wars fan, it's worth watching, but just know you're not going to get a critical view on anything.
I mean, I assume this is like behind the scenes extras on a DVD caliber of introspection.
Yeah, that's accurate. for my plug. I, with Dan Cassino and Taylor Cole, have created a new podcast that is about to debut. It is called The Great American Pop Culture Quiz Show. If you like Game Time, you're going to like this one. Where Game Time is about TV, this is about everything about pop culture. It is about 45 minutes an episode. You, the listeners, are the contestants. So if that is of interest to you, you can sign up for a chance to be on season one right now. Go to usaquizshow.com, sign up there. And then when we're ready, probably in a few weeks, we're going to announce a debut date. Maybe you'll be on the show. It's very serious. We're having a season. There's playoffs. There's going to be a winner. You're going to win fame and fortune, no fortune. And it's a lot of fun. We've been doing a lot of tests. Tara's been on it. Sarah's been on it.
Lots of past guests of this show.
It's super fun.
A lot of fun. I really enjoy doing it. In fact, later on in this episode, we're going to have a game created by our host, Taylor Cole.
Oh.
So that. So once again, usaquizshow.com if that is of interest to you. And that should be debuting sometime in the summer. On the next Extra Extra Hot Great, this Friday, it is TV's Worst Teachers. Everybody is learning about what a good job teachers actually do with your rotten kids now that they're your problem. But we're going to look at some of TV's worst teachers.
That was not directed at you specifically, Stephanie, just because you're here.
No, I'll take it. Yeah. It's fair.
That is for our Patreon supporters. You can be a supporter at patreon.com/extrahotgreat. And next week on EHG Prime, we have longtime contributor Dan Cassino coming to talk about another ABC game show summer fun extravaganza, hopefully called Don't, Simply Don't. So look forward to that next week with Mr. Dan Cassino. And lastly, we are doing another Forcening special episode sometime in the near future, but we thought this time, instead of a sort of circle jerky one forces the other within me, Tara, and Sarah, we would have, for the next 3 weeks, our guest is going to pick one of us and force them to watch an episode, and that's what we'll be doing for the Forcening episode. So, Stephanie Green, I heard as soon as you were told about this, you were like, oh, I got it. I don't have to think about it. So lay it on us, who it is for and what is it?
Well, Dave, this is for you.
Okay.
And Tara was like, oh, I can't wait to see what dating show you're going to make Dave watch. And you're close, but not quite. So okay. I'm going to force in Dave to watch season one. There was only one season, and that's probably a good thing. Episode 6 of The Real Housewives of Auckland. this, admittedly, is a Housewives deep cut. Like most, I'd say, Housewives franchise watchers haven't even seen the Auckland version, but it's bizarre. This episode is, in my opinion, iconic. It actually made me scream out loud the first time I watched it, and I think you'll know why, but I think it will irritate / baffle Dave on many levels, so I'm really excited to see how that goes.
That is what you want in a forcing, is you want bafflement and perhaps resentment at the end of it. That sounds like a perfect
I'm okay with it.
All right, we'll check that out in a few weeks.
Today's extra credit comes to us from David Ellis Dickerson. He calls it the one where the titles have a theme, and he writes, certain shows like Friends, Community, and Orphan Black have episode titles that share a theme across the entire run of the show. Take a show that does not have such a theme and suggest one. For example, I've always thought it would have been fun if Once Upon a Time had only titles that sounded like Once Upon a Time. For example, Rumps Upon a Crime, Prince Upon a Dime, Rapunzel Upon a Climb, etc. So I'll go first. I tried to pick a show that I didn't think anyone else would choose, obviously Under the Dome. And my theme, since it's Under the Dome, what else could it be but containers? So I actually went back to the real episode rundowns for this for maximum accuracy. Okay. Here we go. Season 1, Episode 5, originally called The Endless Thirst. No more. Now it's called Reusable Water Bottle. Season 1, Episode 6, no longer called Imperfect Circles, but since it involves someone going into premature labor, Incubator.
Uh-huh.
Season 1, Episode 10, no longer let the games begin, but since one figures heavily in the episode plot, safety deposit box.
Okay.
Season 1, Episode 13, no longer called curtains, but since a plot point involves a monarch butterfly hatching, what would that be, guys?
Cocoon.
Correct. Season nice. 2, Episode 2, no longer called infestation, but since it's about the town's food supply...
Tupperware?
Yes.
Really?
Good job, Dave. Stephanie, would you like to go next?
Yeah, I've really struggled with this, you guys. And I just decided to look at one of my favorite shows and see if the episode names had a theme. So I found out that Freaks and Geeks sort of half-assed its naming convention. So some of the episodes followed the pattern X and Y like Freaks and Geeks. So they had Tests and Brass, Tricks and Treats, Girlfriends and Boyfriends. But other episodes didn't. So, for example, there was The Garage Door, which was the episode that I successfully argued into the canon, by the way.
Yep.
And Kim Kelly is my friend. So my idea was just to rename all the episodes to conform to the Freaks and Geeks pattern. So, for example, the episode currently titled Kim Kelly is My Friend could be Kim's and Jim's. Believe it or not, that episode does involve gym class. So that was... probably the best one I came up with. And then The Garage Door could be called like Cheating Dads and Feeling Sads. I couldn't, or Dads and, or just Dads and Sads. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I gave up after those two. It really did me in trying to even come up with that. So sorry.
Fair enough.
Really frustrating when there's one or two outliers in a pattern.
Yeah.
I felt the same way.
Yeah, I agree.
Speaking about The Mandalorian, The Mandalorian had the something for each one until the last episode. And it was like something different and it drove me nuts. I was like, the title is right there.
Yeah.
It was like the whatever. Yeah. And then they didn't do it. I'm like, grr. The other thing I don't like is when they put the title of the episode in the show.
Yeah.
Like Star Trek The Next Generation. And then there's that level of annoyance. But the one on top of that is when they put quotes around it. Like, we know it's a fucking title. Anyway, sorry.
Sarah, would you like to go next?
Sure. If you had Sarah uses The Sopranos for the extra credit, just stamp that on your bingo card. That's what I went with. Each season, you could go one of a couple of different ways with this. The way I decided to go is that each season is a song title from a different Jersey artist. So season one is Sinatra, season two is Bon Jovi, like pick whichever season you want for the Springsteen, which duh. You could, like Bruce Springsteen has like a gazillion songs and you could bend them to fit various episode titles. So you could just do all Springsteen for all six seasons or seven seasons, however you think of it. But like for the first season, if you went Bruce, you would have Backstreets, you would have Night, Glory Days, Badlands, My Hometown, Brilliant Disguise, No Surrender, Tougher Than the Rest, Born to Run, Cover Me, Meeting Across the River, you could use like five times, Darkness on the Edge of Town.
Yep.
Sinatra, if you want to use him for season four, instead of calling White Caps, you could call it Love and Marriage. You can call any episode in the Wee Small Hours, probably. they do use It Was a Very Good Year in some, I think the season two premiere.
Opener? I think you're right.
Yeah, but you could definitely throw that in somewhere. That's life. So there's a lot of potential there, but I think the way to do it probably is to just use Springsteen because he just has so many songs and so many of them talk about this like misunderstood ground down hero who has insomnia. So perfect. So nice. That's the direction I went. I'm not sure which season we would use Fountains of Wayne or Blues Traveler on anyway. So let's just stick with Bruce.
Kind of reminds me of the one half of the season for News Radio where they inexplicably start doing Led Zeppelin songs without
in
rhyme or reason.
Complete non sequitur that makes no sense.
Yeah. In album names. Yeah.
Yeah.
I kind of respect that.
Mm-hmm. My first idea was to do Downton Abbey, which has no episode titles.
Most British shows don't. Yeah.
They would all be the names or elements of snaps from the Dowager Countess, like, you know. Series 2, Episode 3, What's a Weekend? Yeah, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But the one I went for, and I do apologize, I didn't actually check if they have a rubric for their episodes, but let's just go with it, was the Amazon series, The Boys. And what I thought is because The Boys is a twisted take on superhero movies and comic books, that they would all be twisted takes on existing superheroes. So possible episode titles include Mean Lantern, Plunder Woman, Dead Poo, Crack Widow, Dr. Mange, Mr. Sarcastic, Prick Fury, Swear Devil, Professor Sex, Captain Larval, Night Mauler, Martian Manpunter, Danny Rand, The Iron Cyst, and just because I enjoyed the visual, The Amazing Cider Man.
Hi, Extra Hot Great Friends. This is Francoise, and today I'm submitting Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, Season 1, Episode 13, Josh and I Go to Los Angeles, for the canon. There's already one episode of Crazy Ex in the canon, so the series' canon worthiness is not in question. Let me tell you why I think this episode exemplifies the very best of what the series does. First, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend was always about subverting rom-com tropes, often playing them straight and saddling them with real-life consequences. Trent was one of the major ways they did this by having this unsympathetic and very creepy dude engage in the exact same behaviors as Rebecca. In this episode, we see Trent take advantage of an admittedly weird situation by kissing Rebecca with tongue and then manipulating and blackmailing Rebecca into letting him stay the night. Granted, she keeps her bathing suit on, but still. And yet, he keeps making it clear that in his own mind, he's the protagonist of an epic love story. The same pattern of thinking that Rebecca has been using to justify her own behaviors, which we see in clip one.
You should lock your back patio. I'm worried about your security.
Oh my God, are you gonna kill me?
No, why would I kill you? I love you.
What?
Rebecca Bunch, I have loved you since the moment that I saw you freshman year in the cafeteria. You were eating a mac and cheese sandwich.
But it's the episode's kicker that really lays bare how brilliantly the show uses Trent to critique Rebecca's behavior. He starts to read her a letter with the exact same melody that Rebecca used to woo Josh in a previous episode in clip two.
Okay, I understand, but are you sure I have to go?
Yes, Trent.
But I never got a chance to read you something. I wrote you a letter.
Okay, fine.
Okay. Dear Rebecca Nora Bunch.
This kicker is so funny and so unexpected and forces the audience to reconsider what we had maybe thought of to be a sweet or romantic gesture in a previous episode. Second, while Crazy Ex-Girlfriend is busy subverting rom-com tropes, it's also a great rom-com. The love triangle in this episode is a master of the genre. No one can smile with his whole body the way that Josh Chan does, and their chemistry builds through the episode until that electric kiss in the courthouse. But the show is also building up Greg's love for Rebecca through the scene in the bar culminating in clip three.
Did you see that? She's crazy. Who goes into a courtroom and says all of that? She's...
Oh my God. I know what's happening.
What?
Look, I've seen a lot of Hallmark movies, and the look on people's faces before they run and confess their feelings, that's your face.
Just because it's self-aware doesn't mean it's not an expert rom-com, and the audience is genuinely torn between Rebecca's two love interests by the time Greg sees Josh and Rebecca's kiss. His disappointment is so heartbreaking, and I remember watching this for the first time feeling genuinely conflicted. Who was a better match for Rebecca? Third, this episode is already beginning to lay a foundation for what would become one of the biggest signatures of the show, that mental illness is a normal part of the human experience and shouldn't be stigmatized. In this case, we learn of Bert's mental illness, which will eventually become a major plot point in later episodes when he's part of Rebecca's group therapy and eventually an investor in the firm. But in this episode, he admits to being a diagnosed schizophrenic, which is all that it takes to wipe out a lifetime of expertise and advanced degrees, which clearly isn't fair. Crazy Ex is already laying the foundation for its argument that you can be smart and talented and mentally ill, and that one doesn't disqualify the other. Fourth, this episode is a great example of my theory that White, Josh, and Daryl are the secret protagonists of this show, I Am Not a Crackpot. These two are the only two people in a relationship that consistently communicate openly and easily about their feelings without playing games. In this case, in the throes of his new crush and Daryl recently understanding that he's bisexual, Daryl tries to hide white Josh away, and Josh just immediately states his problem and his feelings, and that's that in clip four.
So anyway, I was thinking maybe later we would go out for a little beverage.
What's that accent? What are we doing?
I don't know. I don't know. I'm sorry. But what do you think? You want to maybe go get a drink later?
Yeah, sure.
All right.
Why not? We just go to home base. Or Jimmy's House of Spirits has a great Chardonnay.
Well, the thing is, I was thinking that maybe I would take you to La Cité of Los Angeles.
Mm.
Accent happened again. I don't know what's going on. It keeps coming up.
So just to be clear, you want to get a drink, but just not any place where people we know might see us.
Exactly.
Okay, look, Daryl, I am cool with whatever you need to do in your own life. It's all good, but I'm not going to go back into the closet. Not for anybody. I didn't come out until I was 12. Those were some tough years.
Listen to that clear and honest communication. By the end of the episode, Daryl understands he was wrong, doesn't want to drag white Josh into the closet with him, and so he comes out and decides to date Josh publicly. I love this couple so much. Fifth and finally, we love this show for the musical numbers, and this episode's songs are some of the best. The Jap Rap battle is amazing. It has that note-perfect early 90s De La Soul Far Side beat. The lyrics are clever, funny, and brutal in clip five.
It's a Jap battle.
A what?
A Jewish American princess.
Rap battle.
Daughters of rivers.
Spittin' mad flow.
Fight back from offensive.
Too bad, yo, oh, snap. It's a Jap battle rap.
Look, academically, you could never catch me. You were close, but no match. Scholastically, no how, no way. I put the OG in 5.0 GPA. Well, speaking of which, are you AP graded? Cause these days you look a bit heavily weighted. And all your book cracking don't make up for the fact that I'm strapped with that killer instinct that you lack. Sweetheart, here's what you're not understanding. I'm street smart.
You mean cause you minored in urban planning?
Bitch, I know you. That tough act's a bluff. So shake it, Bavaka, shut the hell up.
I have watched this musical number easily a dozen times, and if you don't think this song is amazing, then you're tripping like Birthright. Also, do yourself a favor and please watch Josh Chan as the hype man in the background if you want to bring yourself some joy. I love when Crazy X does great big musical theater numbers, not just spoofs of popular musical genres. And this episode has one of those big, show-stopping numbers as they enter the courthouse in clip six.
Can you hear a trickling sound? That's the leaky sink of change. It's a drip, drip, drip that no handyman can fix. For we shall not be ignored till our honor is restored and your basement is flooded with justice. Soon the raging waters will crash upon the shore. When we sing of raging waters, it's not just a metaphor. What we mean is it's also a water park in San Dimas. Put that set aside, it's not what we're marching for. Can you hear a trickling sound? That's the faulty faucet of truth. It's a drip, drip, drip that will make you go, what is that we shout?
I have never seen Les Mis, and even I know that this is a note-perfect spoof of Les Mis. That's how good it is. And finally, we get a short but sweet reprise of one of the very best songs this show has ever done, Settle For Me, in clip seven.
Don't settle for me.
What?
Come on, dude, don't settle for me. Trust me, I know guys, and that look in your eyes means you're in love.
Love? Who are you all of a sudden?
Shut up and listen to my wise reprise. We've had some fun together.
Hold on a second, Heather.
But I need, like, so much more. I'm way too badass to be someone you settle for.
So for all these reasons, for dismantling rom-com tropes while still being an incredibly satisfying rom-com, for destigmatizing mental illness, for giving us hashtag goals with Daryl and White Josh, and for excellent musical numbers, I hope you will vote this superlative episode of Crazy Ex-Girlfriend into the canon. Thank you.
Thank you, Francoise. Stephanie, you picked this from the list of submissions. Why don't you start us off?
Okay. I thank you for that presentation. That was persuasive, but I don't know, guys. I think I'm going to need more persuading on this one. I love Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. And to me, what sets the show apart is the songs. And while those, both of the songs she pointed out, actually, I guess she highlighted three of them, the Rap Battle, the Les Mis inspired one, and then the Settle For Me reprise, all are good. I mean, every song the show has produced is good, but they're just not up there in the firmament for me with this show. And for me to vote an episode into the canon, I think it has to have like a song that I remembered. So, you know, Sexy Getting Ready song, Let's Generalize About Men, my personal favorite, Don't Be a Lawyer, Face Your Fears, Where's the Bathroom, Settle For Me, the original, any of those, like those are just, you know, off the top of my head. I'm sure if I went to a list of Crazy Ex-Girlfriend songs, there would be like 10 others that I'd put ahead of any of the songs in this episode. Of course, that's subjective, but, you know, that's the exercise here. For me, the songs weren't there and the plot was not engaging enough. I didn't like, I remembered vaguely seeing this episode the first time around, but I didn't remember like the courtroom stuff or even the ins and outs with White Josh and Derek. And sidebar, I am not as in love with that couple as Francoise is. I think White Josh always seemed kind of like above it all and not that into Daryl, but that's just me. So I don't know. I mean, it was enjoyable to watch, but I'm not sure it's canon worthy just because the overall package wasn't strong enough for me.
I'll go next. I did pitch the episode with the original Settle For Me to the canon and it did not get in. So not that I'm wounded by it, but yeah, no, it didn't.
Well, I would have voted for it, Tara.
Thank you. That said, I do think the Jap Rap Battle is an all-timer. I love it. I'm surprised to hear you say that it wasn't memorable for you because I still think about it frequently. I love that one. In terms of the plot of the episode, I mean, I think Francoise makes a lot of great points, especially regarding Trent and how this episode, which in a lot of ways feels like a season finale, I think possibly because it was conceived to be usable as a season finale if it had to be. It's the 13th episode of the first season and, you know, usually in network TV, if you don't get the back nine, this could have been the end of the season. And it functions that it feels like it was designed to function that way if they didn't get an order for more episodes, because it does recapitulate a lot of stuff from the beginning of the season, not just with the reprise of Settle For Me, but with the way that Trent, you know, echoes back Rebecca's arrival in town and all the stuff that she did to Josh and that, as Francoise said, he's now doing to her. And also the way it, you know, she, as Francoise also said, it has the researcher character, you know, normalizing the idea that people who have mental illness can also be functional and that doesn't necessarily erase their expertise or make them not reliable witnesses in a court case and stuff, which is certainly a theme that this show kept coming back to, mostly with regard to Rebecca's character as she had highs and lows with her own mental health over the seasons and the years. I agree with you that White Josh did seem above it all. I didn't always buy him and Daryl as a couple, and I don't think this is a great episode other than the reasons that Francoise said in terms of him, you know, clearly stating his desires and his needs in their relationship, mostly though for my purposes, because I thought White Josh was always a really funny character and this episode doesn't give him anything funny to do at all. He's really just kind of a straight man, no pun intended, for Daryl to kind of bounce off. But yeah, I think Francoise made a great case. I like the way the songs are used to, as I said, to echo back themes that were brought up earlier in the season. I have to give a shout out to the incredibly crisp enunciation in the Jap battle, because that song would not have worked if you could not make out every syllable, and you can, and that's crucial. There's, you know, such attention paid to the song production on this show and also the songwriting, of course. RIP Adam Schlesinger, lost too soon to COVID-19 earlier this year. So, you know, I can see your points, but this episode does work for me as a turning point for the season. So I was happy to revisit it, and I will throw it to Dave.
I take your point about White Josh. I feel like he is the character they use to cut through the artifice of the show's setup.
Yeah. You know,
like he's always the one that sort of like peels back the onion of this like musical tinged universe that's there. And he doesn't get to do that in this episode. I agree that the Jap Battle is a really good song. I've never watched Les Mis, so I did not cotton to that whole thing. You know, that was a takeoff of that. There are certain things that happen in Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, like there's a tier of care that goes into a song, and I usually measure it by the number of times they break out of the, I don't know what you call it in music, but you know, like the rhyming scheme or whatever. Like there'll be a part where obviously it's supposed to be one word in that line, but then they go, and then the thing that happened to Amanda, and that happens a lot in that song. And I feel like the more of that, the less energy they put into making that song work unto itself. But I know it's like funny when they do that, but they do it so often. I feel like it's like Tracy Morgan from 30 Rock, like doing the breaking thing. I'm doing breaking, you know, like it has to be done in moderation or it loses its power. And I felt like the show did it way too often. And that song was one of the examples of it doing way too often. Nobody's mentioned it, but I love the whole dialogue around Chinatown when they're just talking about it, like the whole water scheme and how it's like Chinatown and describing it.
And no one's seen it.
Oh, now I gotta see it. Just like it's a throwaway line that was like just pitch perfect timing.
Also the BJ Novak cameo, which I forgot to mention.
Very funny. Another small moment. And the other small moment that made me really smile was Trent pulling his note out to read to Rebecca out of like a very used baggie.
Ziploc.
Yeah. Like the kind of baggie that my dad used to carry loose change around,
like
in the car, you know, you'd have the baggie of loose change. You could tell like the plastic had weakened. It was very crinkly and then the light shone on it. Like it was a very unique choice. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just a new baggie he put it in. Like this is one that has been in his pocket a long time. And I thought it like told a little story without actually saying anything. Mm-hmm. I kind of agree with Stephanie that there is things to enjoy about this episode, but it doesn't stack up to some of the greater episodes that this show has provided. And I feel like they're at the start of really ramping up some of the themes they're talking about, especially mental illness, which really goes in high gear in later seasons. And this one feels like the start of a lot of things, but not like the perfection of a lot of things. So I'm going to say like, it's a good episode. Absolutely watch it. But I think there are a few episodes that I could put in the canon before this one. And, you know, there's only so many episodes of this show. Sarah.
Well, as you know, one of the Buncee criteria is, did I want to keep watching another episode right after? I did. This is definitely on my list to watch the whole series. And every time it comes up for the canon, I am like annoyed that I don't have more time to start doing that. Because the Jap Rap Battle was so good. I watched it three times. I'm always here for Cornell Shade. Sorry, Ithaca. And there's like, you know, Francoise made this point about how like mental illness is just a part of life. It's one part of a character's life. And like the sort of other way that the show really appeals to me in terms of letting characters be like a more than just a couple of shorthand traits is that, you know, I think TV really has difficulty with like a like 360 woman that like she's the sort of, you know, Daffy character that's like, well, you know, he'll see me eat a piece of ham off the ground and he'll move on, which like that's a good line. But so many shows would just make that the whole character that like if a woman has these, let's call it the Ike Barinholtz in the Mindy Project type of tendencies. She can't also be a competent attorney. She can't be all of those things that like all of us are. And I enjoyed that in this episode, as in the other episodes I've seen, that she's able to be sort of like sharp and with it. And that Trent is like, well, you know, I believe in you and that's what counts, right? And she's like, no. And but at the same time, she can be this sort of dizzy, clueless person, and those things can coexist. And you don't realize until you see that, especially in a woman on TV who is of, let's say, recognizable proportion. Yeah. Lovely, but also, you know, doesn't look like she was extruded in a factory and rinsed in the waters of the Bachelor fountain and then put on a cop show. That you don't realize how uncommon that is. So, yeah, I enjoyed this. I laughed a lot. I love that some of these characters will do, like, White Josh, sort of the way that he's lifting weights, like he's doing the reverse, like carefully letting the weight down to work his tries. And it's like, I don't know who thought that he should do that, but it's perfect. It's absolutely perfect. And there's so many moments like that in any Crazy Ex-Girlfriend episode that I've seen. So I enjoyed this presentation and this episode a lot. And I feel like the vote is not going to go our way, T-Bone, but I guess we should find out.
All right. One thing I forgot, I'll just add right here at the end, is I thought this episode could use more Paula, who's always my favorite character.
That is a great point. Great point.
So let's put this to the official vote in order of arguments. Stephanie, what vote you?
Sorry, it's a no, but I did enjoy it.
Tara?
I'm going to vote yay.
I'm going to vote no. Sarah?
I'm going to vote yay.
All right. So that's a tie. So unfortunately, ties go to an unsuccessful case for the canon. It was a heartbreaker, but Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, Season 1, Episode 13, you're hereby not in the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It is time for the winner and the loser of the week. Tara has the winner.
Well, we talked about HBO Max earlier with regard to Love Life. It is not the most popular show on that platform, believe it or not. In fact, the most popular show on HBO Max, more popular than Game of Thrones and The Sopranos, is Looney Tunes cartoons. Let's chalk this up to...
Love that.
Babysitting during COVID-19.
Exactly, yes. Parents being relieved that there's a new streaming platform with new kids content they can park their children in front of that they haven't already exhausted.
I read they gave Elmer Fudd, they took away his gun and gave him a sickle.
That's in the new one.
In the new, yeah.
Yes, he will not have a gun anymore. He will have other weapons of destruction, which, like, I mean, feels like a lateral move,
it
but
does.
Great, I guess. Yeah. I picture him having a man-splitting katana, like on that episode of News Radio we watched last week. Anyway.
All right, loser of the week?
Big Scythe? No. Cops and Live PD have both been pulled from their schedules on Paramount and A&E, but with a twist for each. Live PD was supposed to, quote, celebrate its 300th episode over last weekend. They decided not to do that because, duh, not a great time for copaganda. I was sort of interested to see how they were going to try to spin that. Mm. But I think Tulsa PD, which was like the one that spent the most time on screen, decided that this was not a good look for them correctly. Mm-hmm. So I was interested to see how they were going to spin it, but they decided not to go live last weekend. However, as of Friday, like A&E's entire schedule from noon until 2 a.m. on Friday was Live PD reruns.
Jesus.
Like, guys, you don't have anything else.
Okay.
You could put on, maybe borrow a Looney Tune, something. Meanwhile, on the Paramount Network, Cops was supposed to have its 33rd season premiere. And not only was that pulled, but every mention of the existence of Cops was scrubbed from the Paramount website. And they're, I guess, just acting like, but Cops?
Cops
what?
Who?
No hablo. Like, really, guys? So, yeah, good luck subtracting that from everyone's consciousness.
From like culture.
I get, yeah, they're trying, but they're very trying is my point.
speak about things that are very trying. Do you know what time it is?
You're welcome. It's game time.
This is the sixth game time of the season. Season scores are Sarah in the lead with 3, value guest right behind at 2, and Tara with nothing. Today we are playing Songs in the Key of Hulk from Taylor Cole, who earns himself an extra credit topic. There is no sadder sound in the world for an extra hot great host or guest than the lonely man, better known as the sad walking away music from The Incredible Hulk. It's the sound we all wish we could filter out of our ears because it is the sound of failure. Your failure to successfully induct a canon episode. This game will test that ability to filter out that sound of failure by making you identify the melodies to other TV themes which have been transformed into the style of The Lonely Man. To help you narrow it down, all the show's themes you'll be hearing today are from shows that have successful canon entries. So at least should be somewhat
familiar. Okay.
All right, let's throw it to Picky to see who will be going first.
We will start with Sarah.
All right, our order today is Sarah, Stephanie, Tara. We have 18 questions today. Feel free to ask for a replay if you need it. No equalizer challenge zones. Are we ready to play Songs in the Key of Hulk?
Yes.
Yes.
All right, Sarah D. Bunting, we are starting with you. Each one of these songs will start with the opening notes of The Lonely Man to get you in the mood, so then start listening for the theme after that. Here we go. First theme for Sarah.
That is so good.
You should say, Dave, before Sarah answers, that Taylor is the pianist on all of these.
He is.
He arranged these himself.
He is a music teacher.
Wow.
Really good.
Oh, Taylor S. Cole, you are a delight. SDB Cooper is prepared to respond to this question. That is not Sad Men, but Mad Men.
Right.
I mean, that's showing off, but I'll allow it.
Yeah.
All right, Stephanie, here is your first theme.
I don't know. It sounded familiar, but I have no idea.
Do you want me to play it again for you?
Yeah.
All right, Stephanie, any idea?
It's going to bug me because I think I watch whatever show it is and the minor key is like throwing me off. I don't know. Sorry.
Yeah.
That was the theme to Friends. Sad Friends.
Wow.
All right, Tara, here's your first theme.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
30 Rock.
That's fun. Wow. All right, back to Sarah. Are you ready, Sarah?
Yes. Can I hear it again, please?
You certainly can.
I can't pull it. Benson.
It's not Benson. Anybody? No?
Oh.
Okay. Yeah. Gilmore Girls, yeah?
That's correct.
Oh, well.
Back to Stephanie. Oof.
Oh, I know this one. Crazy Ex-Girlfriend.
You are correct. That was from the episode that took place in the saloon. Back to Sarah. No,
nope.
Back to Tara.
Yes.
Here we go.
Also mentioned in this episode,
yep.
Freaks and Geeks.
Oh my God, nice pull.
Well done, good one. Sarah, are you ready for your next theme?
I don't think so, but let's do it anyway. I'm going to need to hear it again, please.
Here you go. Idea. Make that theme happy.
I mean, vaguely in the mists, it is coalescing, but not quickly enough, so I will guess The Sopranos, and let's move on.
Jabba the Hutt. Jabba the Hutt. Was Parks and Rec.
Sarah skipping intro in all those episodes she just had to watch for her forcing.
Yes, she did.
Okay, Stephanie, are you ready?
Yep. Can you play it again, please?
Idea what that theme is.
Again, that sounds vaguely familiar, but I cannot put my finger on it, so I'm gonna pass.
Let me help you a little bit here.
Okay.
Used to be friends.
Oh no.
To Tara, are you ready?
Yep. Do not know.
Do not know. This is the one that gave me the most trouble.
Okay.
When I was listening to him try to figure him out.
Open to steel meals.
That's pretty good. Okay, let's see. Sarah, are you ready for question 10?
Yeah.
Unchanged from the original, frankly.
Yeah. I never really noticed the plaintiveness in the original. This is Clone High.
To Stephanie, are you ready for your next
theme? Ready as I'll ever be.
Here we go. right, what's that theme?
The Office?
Is it The Office?
Yay!
Oh. All right, this is for Tara. We'll take us into our score break. Are you ready?
Mm-hmm.
Any idea? I need to hear it again?
No, I don't know it. Sure hearing don't? It again is not going to help.
All right.
No. Oh, sure. I'm no Superman.
Indeed, that was the theme to Scrubs. That is about two-thirds done. Let's get the scores, please.
Well, it could not be more exciting. We are all tied up.
All
with
right.
2 points apiece.
Woo! Well, everybody's got 2 questions left. That looks right. Are you ready, Sarah D. Bunting?
Yes, sir. Again, please. Fuck. It's just out of reach. Sopranos again, why not?
News Radio.
I wouldn't have gotten that either, and we've been watching it for the past week.
Stephanie, here is your second to last theme.
Okay. Time, please.
Absolutely. Do you know that theme, Stephanie?
No, it feels like one I watch, but I can't. I don't know what it is.
That is incorrect.
Anyone?
It was.
Oh, Muppet Show. Got it.
God damn it.
That was, God damn it, the Muppet Show.
Why
correct.
Why do we always come here?
All right, this is for Tara and could give her the lead if answered correctly. Tara, your theme.
Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
That's how you do it.
Nice.
Okay.
Brooklyn Nine-Nine, correct. All right, Tara takes the lead. Everybody's got one question left. Here is Sarah D. Buntings.
Thank you for being a friend, Picky. I was wondering if that was going to come through, and I think it did. Golden Girls.
Correct. All right, Stephanie, you need this to stay in the game. Are you ready? Here is your theme.
Okay.
Idea what that is.
Could I hear it again?
You can. And
thanks.
Here it is.
So close, but I don't know.
Don't know it.
Sarah?
Does Sarah know it?
Steel Neil Haver? God.
Yeah, no, I'm here. I'm just concerned about burning a steel meal, but you know what? Let's do it. Steel Neil.
Right. Yes.
Is this The Sopranos?
Recent canon inductee Community.
That's why I thought you might know it. I wasn't trying to entrap you.
She was, and she did.
I was not.
Mwahaha, says Tara. Less steel meals for Sarah. All right, Tara, if you get this, you win.
Yep.
If you miss it, we're into a tiebreaker between you and Sarah.
Yep. I can't believe I'm gonna guess this. Is it Peep Show? Oh my God.
Wow.
Wow.
That.
That was a good pull.
Man.
Because that's
wow.
not a show you I'm think impressed. Of when you go through the canon list in your head.
But nope.
It is on the canon. And you got it. So Tara wins today, but I have the tiebreaker.
All right.
Back into play. Stephanie, you're in this as well. Sarah, Tara, first person to shout out the correct answer will win a steel meal for future use. Everybody ready?
Yes.
Yep.
Here we go.
Twin Peaks?
Correct. So, Tara, you win yourself a steel meal for future use, and you are the winner today.
Yay. Woo!
Tara!
Tara. Congratulations, Tara.
That was great.
Well Tara. Done.
Well, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We follow the path to Cinemax's South African import trackers before going around the dial with stops at Love Life, Married at First Sight Australia, Please Like Me, 13 Reasons Why, and Disney Gallery : The Mandalorian. David Ellis Dickerson asked about shows that could adopt themed episode titles, and Francoise unsuccessfully argued that Crazy Ex-Girlfriends Josh and I Go to Los Angeles should go into the canon. We crown winners and losers of the week, and Tara was the winner of this week's Game Time from Taylor. Next up, Bad Teachers on Extra Extra Hot Great, and on the next EHG Prime, it's Don't Remember.
We're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
don't settle for me,
Sarah D. Bunting.
What's that accent? What are we doing?
And Stephanie Green.
Do I speak Afrikaans?
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
Look at me. Thanks for listening.
Yeah.
Okay, you can sleep at the foot of my bed tonight.
Really?
Yeah.
Like a dog?
Yes, Trent, like a dog.
Okay.
Ugh. Please don't look that excited.